Welcome to Canada's most irreverent talk show. This is The Andrew Lawton Show, brought to you by True North.
Hello and welcome to you all. This is Canada's most irreverent talk show, The Andrew Lawton Show on True North, closing out the week on this March 21st. What is March 21st? It's the Fast of Esther, I know, for the Jewish people. I thought there was some other commemorative day that I had remembered that I've now forgotten about. But Sean says it's the day after his birthday. Yeah, that's what I meant there. Happy day after the birthday to all of you Sean Thompsons out there. In any event, it is good to have you aboard it's the first day of spring. That's what I was missing. Let me just check this. First day of spring, because sometimes it's, I think, the 20th. No, that was the 19th, Sean. Will you get with the program? All right, I rescind my belated birthday celebration. I actually didn't know that spring started on March 19th. So anyway, do you feel edified by me just desperately trying to figure out in real time what's going on, where I am? I don't even know what my name is at this point. Welcome, everyone, to the Rosemary Barton Show. This is CBC's The Net. Nope. Sorry, no, Andrew Lawton. All right, well, moving along then. This is a fascinating, fascinating story. The RCMP, typically mired in politics. It's their favorite pastime to just focus on politics and wokeness at the higher level. I'm not talking, of course, about frontline officers, but they inadvertently, I think, stumbled on something that is very politically and socially salient here. Now, whether that was their intention or not, I have no idea, but there was a secret report that was intended for, it was intended for police and senior members of the government to kind of just figure out the threat assessments of the world. But this report, as the National Post frames it, was warning that Canadians may revolt when they realize how broke they are. One of my colleagues, Quinn Patrick, over at True North Wire, he had posted something, he had read the report himself and drew some other aspects from it, such as the fear that RCMP was putting to lawmakers of a paranoid, I'm doing the lopsided air quotes because I don't want to keep punching the mic, paranoid populism sweeping the country. That was the RCMP's concern also in the report. So it's quite fascinating here. What police are saying is that, hey, things are so bad for Canadians. Things are so terrible for people in this country that you may find, if you're a government official, that the peasants might start revolting. That's basically the police's warning here. You think the Freedom Convoy was something, you could see a full-on paranoid populist rebellion against the government. Now, some people might just look and say, all right, well, bring it on. But I kind of take a bigger view of this, a bigger picture view, and say, how does this square with Justin Trudeau's incessant claims that Canada is not broken, that it is in fact offensive or insensitive to say that Canada is broken, which has become a common refrain from Pierre Poilievre and the Conservatives, that Canada is broken. Now, this does not mean Canada is beyond fixing. It just means that things in the country are not working the way they're supposed to. And Justin Trudeau, who always says, oh yes, I support law enforcement and I defend their investigative autonomy and authority and all that jazz, he now will have to answer, okay, how do you square your message that Canada is not broken? It's all hunky-dory, everything's fine, A-okay. And the police saying, okay, things are a little bit rocky. Actually, things are really rocky. Actually, you may find you're dealing with a full-on rebellion on your hand because Canadians are not going to put up with how bad things are. So that is effectively what we're seeing unfolding here. The police are warning that things are just so untenable that they are going to rise up. Now, an uprising could look very different in different contexts. It could just be a big, large protest. It could be general unrest. It could be a little isolated protest. Now, I mean, take the Freedom Convoy as one example. This was a nightmare for law enforcement. They just completely had no idea how to deal with it. It was, for the most part, one main protest in Ottawa. Yes, you had the Coutts protest, which was its own thing. You had, for a time, Windsor, and you had little pop-up ones. But imagine if the organic growth that the Freedom Convoy had in Ottawa was actually in every province across the country. That would actually be incredibly difficult to rein in. That's actually the kind of thing that would have caused the federal government, I suspect, to bring in the military, which, again, we wouldn't put a pass them. Marco Mendicino and David Lametti were just yucking it up in a Signal chat about bringing in the tanks. And, oh, well, I think one might do was, I can't remember if it was Mendicino or Lametti, but both have been fired now, so it doesn't really matter. But this is, I think, a really significant problem. Now, it doesn't take a genius, and it doesn't take even the most perceptive person to look around the country and say, hey, people are struggling. Things are not working for people. And this warning from police, while it may be a little bit on the nose, it's touching on something incredibly important that everyone in the country except Justin Trudeau and the Liberals seems to realize, which is how bad things are for the average person. And to be honest, that ties in quite well, not that it's a favorable segue or a nice segue by any stretch, with what the Jewish community in this country is facing. Yesterday, I spoke about this cartoon that was published in La Presse. It was a vampire Nosferatu play on Benjamin Netanyahu, the prime minister of Israel. It was, I think it was Nosferinhu or Nosferinyahu or Nosferyahu, whatever they called him. But it was this trope of the blood-sucking vampire Jew. An anti-Semitic trope that goes back to anti-Semitic Germany in the early part of the 20th century, Nazi propaganda and the like. And it was a cartoon that passed by several members of the editorial team of La Presse and was eventually pushed out. And then they get caught and see the backlash. And everyone's like, oh, I'm so sorry. I had no idea. Oh, we shouldn't have done. But they did it. They did it. They chose to do it. And I don't see this as being an error in the crafting of the cartoon. I see it as being an error in saying the quiet part out loud and being revealing of what many people would argue, certainly with having seen what's unfolded since October 7th, as being a tragically widespread sentiment among many people in this country. And I guess editorial cartoonists are not immune from that. Now, what was interesting is how the government chose to respond to this. Now, to be fair, Pascal Saint-Ange is the heritage minister. It's not the job of the heritage minister under normal circumstances, I would say, to start criticizing, oh, I didn't like this column, I didn't like that column. Like, that's not the type of thing that we want the minister or any government official to do generally. I will concede that point. And I also want to make it abundantly clear, as disgusting as I found this cartoon, I do not support censorship. I do not believe there was anything illegal about it. And I would reject fully any attempt or any effort by someone to use the weight of the state against La Presse or the cartoonist. I believe the way you condemn and criticize these things is simply by criticizing them and condemning them. You don't need to censor it. In fact, that only turns your foes and opponents into martyrs. But I also think when the minister is going to weigh in, it's interesting to see how she did it.
Again, if you see this cartoon, what do you make of it?
Well, as Heritage Minister, I'm going to be very prudent around the independence of the press. But what I am going to say is that, of course, you know, with everything happening right now in the Middle East and the tension that it's bringing in Canada as well, because communities are feeling this conflict very profoundly, that it's normal that there's critiques with such a cartoon.
Okay, so on one hand, listen, I'm the heritage minister. I support independence of the press. I'm not commenting on it. Had she stopped it there, we might be having a different conversation. But then she went one step further and said, oh, it's normal. It's normal. Now, was this a translation issue like when Trudeau said he found his job boring? I don't know. I mean, she seems to speak English very capably. This was, of course, to the Conservatives seen as highly inadequate. This is MP Michelle Rempel-Garner from the Tory benches speaking out with Pierre-Paul Housse at her side.
Earlier today, in a scrum exiting the Liberal caucus, the Minister of Canadian Heritage failed to condemn a blatantly anti-Semitic trope that was published this morning by La Presse. In fact, she said that discussions around this topic, in response to a question on this, required compassion and respect. There is nothing compassionate or respectful about what La Presse published this morning. It was a Nazi-era anti-Semitic trope, and the Minister of Canadian Heritage had a duty to condemn it. Canadian Jews are facing massive rising levels of anti-Semitism, and for the Minister of Canadian Heritage to say this was about the freedom of the press was an abject failure in her part to address anti-Semitism and to condemn it. There's nothing about freedom of the press.
That was Michelle Rempel-Garner's response to it. Now, to the government's credit, Justin Trudeau did have firmer language when he was asked about it. It's a short clip. You'll blink. If you blink, you'll miss it, but here it is.
First of all, on the La Presse caricature, it is unacceptable to bring back anti-Semitic tropes and allusions like that. It is distasteful and exactly the wrong thing to do, particularly in these times. It is a good thing that it was pulled. It was a good thing that they've apologized, but it never should have happened in the first place.
Now, if I were Justin Trudeau, I would be looking through my wardrobe collection to make sure I didn't have the vampire outfit that they used in the cartoon that I was whipping out at parties for the better part of my 20s and 30s. So Justin Trudeau, again, always has to be very circumspect on anything to do with tropes and costumes and outfits and all that. But at this point, let's assume he hasn't been doing Nosferatu face in his spare time. He came out and said it was unacceptable, which, again, I think is a reasonable condemnation of it. But I think we need to talk about the government's conduct in all of this, because this is the same government that the same week as this unfolds votes against or votes in favor of an NDP motion that at first was trying to immediately and unilaterally recognize the Palestinian nation or a region as a state, that was also going to call for this ceasefire, which again only emboldens and empowers Hamas. We saw the Liberals do a victory lap when they had managed to just soften the edges of the motion a little bit, but they still ended up supporting it with only Anthony Housefather, Marco Mendicino, and Ben Carr having the, I'll say, courage and moral clarity and conviction to stand up and vote against this resolution, against this motion from the NDP. But then you look at the NDP revealing where its loyalties are here. Now, this is Brian Massey, who is an MP in, I believe it's Windsor-Tecumseh or Windsor-Essex. It was one of the Windsor ridings in southwestern Ontario, not far from the U.S. border. This is his take on anti-Semitism.
We've seen a rise of anti-Semitism in the past in this country as well. And I want to note that, Mr. Speaker, because I understand the pain and suffering, because I've seen it in my own community long before even this, where swastikas are painted on sidewalks or in front of people's homes, and all that still exists in our society, and it's something we have to continue to fight against every single day. But we're not going to be able to fix anything right now until there's a ceasefire. And if we can help move other countries in that direction, then we can save lives. And that's the most important thing that I'll continue to resort to.
Anti-Semitism will continue until Israel stops its defensive strikes against Hamas. That's what he's saying there, that we cannot combat anti-Semitism until there is a ceasefire, as though targeting Jews in Canada is conditional on Israel's military decisions. That is his belief. Quite insane that he was doing this. Now, he has apologized. He says, quote, "I am deeply sorry about my comment in the House of Commons linking the ceasefire with tackling anti-Semitism. We must confront anti-Semitism at all times and without preconditions. I want to apologize to all who have been impacted by this comment. I'm committed to repairing the harm that was caused. The rise of anti-Semitism in Canada is not a new problem, but the crisis in the Middle East has made it even worse. As a leader in my community, I have a responsibility to do everything I can to address it." Sounds great. You know, it would have been better in the first place not saying what he said. I don't believe this was a misspeak or a gaffe. I believe that this was fully an example of him saying what I referred to earlier, and I'll refer to again, as the quiet part out loud. This is him being just a little bit too honest about what he thinks, that it is actually incumbent on the Jewish people of Canada to bear the responsibility for what people may take issue with as far as Israel's decisions as a nation, as a state. Now, again, I've said time and time again, it is completely fair game to criticize Israel as a country. It's fair game to debate two-state solution, whether that's effective or viable and what it would look like. It's certainly fair to criticize Benjamin Netanyahu. He is a prime minister. He's a politician. He is no more immune to criticism than a politician in Canada or any other Western country should be. But what's basically at stake here is that Jewish people are seen by this increasingly, I'll say increasing in size and increasing in, what's the best word to put it? Increasing in brazenness group in Canada that believes they are fair game, that believes a Jewish person in downtown Windsor is a fair target for your issues with the Zionist project in the Middle East. That is what these people are saying. And when I have said to people in private conversation, and I've said on the show in the past, that anti-Semitism is the new normal in Canada, there are a lot of people, certainly Jews in this country, who take issue with that because they say, well, this isn't new. This isn't a new problem. You're seeing it for the first time. And I think that's an entirely fair criticism. There are a lot of people. I've generally paid attention to Israel and Jewish issues. It's always been an interest of mine. But there are a lot of people in this country that are completely blindsided by what we've seen in the last several months. And I would go and say that I'm not at all by any stretch perfect. I would say that I have been astonished by the scale of it and by the breadth of this. And you know, I probably wouldn't have seen, if you had asked me before October 7th, that individual businesses would be fair game. I mean, I would have never predicted Cafe Landwehr being targeted in Toronto. I would never have predicted Mount Sinai being protested. Again, just a couple of years ago, we had people saying it's outrageous to protest a hospital when people were protesting over vaccine mandates. But when you're protesting it because it has Sinai in the name, and that's just a little bit too Jewish for our sensibilities, people are saying that is fine. So this is, to be honest, disgraceful. And the Canadian government has a role to play in this. The Canadian government has a role to play. They have made their decisions on Israel, but they have been equivocal at virtually every step. They have been equivocal in terms of their calls for a ceasefire. They've been equivocal in terms of their whether they even condemn this, whether they call them terrorists. They were equivocal and ultimately took the wrong position when there was misinformation circulating that Israel had purportedly bombed a hospital, but it was actually an errant Hamas rocket that had landed in the parking lot adjacent to a hospital. But this was used to justify anti-Israel propaganda. And the part of this that all people in this country need to realize is that this is going to continue. And again, it was very difficult to be an anti-Semite on October 7th, October 8th, October 9th, because there was so much public support for Israel and the Jewish people in the imminent aftermath of it. But the longer it's gone on, the more people have been able to drop that pretend support and let their true colors shine through. And many of those true colors are actually just wrapped in keffiyehs, like the NDP members of parliament were, who decided to stand up and vote for something that so few people had the courage to say and call out for what it was, which was an anti-Israel motion, an anti-Israel resolution. And I know that there are people that in the audience that don't love it. I get accused of being a Zionist shill from time to time. And I say, you know, whether I'm shilling or not, you can decide for yourselves. But Zionism, it should not be the dirty word that so many people have tried to make it out to be. And I played that clip yesterday with Anthony Housefather, and he was saying that very thing, that he is a Zionist because Zionism was the way to give the Jewish people a safe haven in the world that they didn't have anywhere else. And I think there are far too many Canadians that probably wanted to rest on our laurels as a country and say, oh, well, we're a safe place. You can be Jewish here. What's the big deal? And, well, how's that working out for people? It's been a tragic display, and so few people are even now opening their eyes to this. I want to welcome into the program Shimon Kofler-Fogel, who is the president and CEO of the Center for Israel and Jewish Affairs. Shimon, I know this has been such a tremendously difficult time for your community over the last several months now, but I wanted to ask you about this resolution, because a lot of the language that the NDP used in this, that the Liberals ended up using, on the surface, lacks the, if you don't know what you're looking for, it could look like it's a reasonable motion.
Yeah, I think that was the intent, to make it sound like motherhood and apple pie. But, you know, words have meanings and they're code for lots of different things. And this was not a motion that was advanced with a righteous spirit. There's an agenda. It includes trying to marginalize and isolate Israel within the international community. Israel isn't just a place, and Zionism isn't just a movement to find safe haven for Jews. It's about repatriation to their ancestral homeland after forced exile for 2,000 years. Canada saw fit to endorse the idea of a Jewish state. They did it in 1947. Lester Pearson was actively involved in advancing it. And all of a sudden, we get to a place I couldn't help but you describing some of the MPs in the House. Many of them are detractors, are also wearing these new necklaces that have a map of Palestine on it, which would be fine, except that the map that's represented in the piece of jewelry is the entirety of that real estate. So it doesn't really leave any place for a Jewish state. And I think that that's really the most telling interpretation or understanding of this chant that has become their mantra, from the river to the sea. It means not having a Jewish state. It means destroying the Jewish state. And I think that Canada is a country that should be standing up unequivocally along with its democratic ally in the region. And unfortunately, we haven't seen that much.
Well, you raise an important point. And, you know, oftentimes people in the Canadian government will restate the Canadian government's position of a two-state solution. And you know, not delving into the weeds on the very, very complex history of negotiations and talks over the last few years, a lot of these activists are going very much further than that. They want a one-state solution, and that is one singular Palestinian state.
So I think that's exactly right. A two-state solution was attainable not once or twice or three times. Five very specific and precise plans had been put forward with the endorsement of the Americans, of other segments of the international community. They were rejected each and every time by the Palestinian leadership. So there has to be some agency, there has to be accountability for the decisions that they make. Their situation is of their own making. They're the authors of it, just as Hamas is the author of the misery that is now being experienced in Gaza. And I think that there has to be a consistency in countries like Canada demanding accountability and recognition of at whose feet does the situation lay.
Your organization has done for years a lot of legwork on engaging with politicians. I know you've always prided yourselves on doing it in a very respectful way. You don't like immediately going to these public confrontations and condemnations of these people. You like to educate and inform. And I know you've brought members of parliament from, I don't know about all parties, but certainly from multiple parties to Israel. In your conversations, when you square those up that you've had with people to what you see from them publicly, I'm curious if you have a read on whether these are people that are just simply against Israel, or whether there are people that, you know, that privately they've been on side, but now it's not trendy to support Israel or to support the Jewish community.
Yeah, so I think unpacking that is a little complicated, because there are a few things going on. First, there are those that are simply hostile. They bought into the anti-Israel narrative that has been promoted by our cousins, but it has also been picked up by the radical left, those who have been promoting this woke ideology, which divides the world into two. You're either part of the oppressed segment or you're the oppressor. And Israel, and the Jewish people for that matter, are the poster children for that white privilege that, if you can imagine, attaches importance to things like meritocracy and accountability. So you have this movement that has been just unrelenting in its attacks on the Jewish community, the Jewish state. That's one piece. The second piece, and I think that it was insightful for you to flag that, is that group of individuals who are inclined to be supportive, but who have been intimidated and chilled and are afraid of being targeted themselves and canceled for fear of coming out and expressing their views. So essentially, they've been silenced. What they do isn't entirely what they say. You know, it's something that we, the Jewish community, may be the canary in the coal mine for, but we had better wake up, because this is a challenge fundamentally to Western civilization, to the values that have informed our society here for hundreds of years, and they're under challenge by those who espouse this Marxist-Leninist view. They got it wrong every iteration so far. They've now stumbled over a new configuration that they think is going to get them some purchase.
One question I have to ask you about Shimon is how oftentimes Jewish people are used as a bit of a shield in this debate. There have always been some Jewish organizations that have been very anti-Zionist, even though they're certainly a minority of the Jewish community. And then you have, even in Parliament, Yara Sachs, who last week was holding hands with Mahmoud Abbas in the West Bank, and this week voting in favor of this motion, a Jewish woman representing a riding with a large Jewish community. And I've seen online that being used as, again, I'll say the word again, a shield by people to say, oh, well, even Yara Sachs is supporting it. So no, it's not anti-Jewish.
Yeah, so I would make a distinction between Yara Sachs and some of those groups.
And that's fair. That's fair, yes.
Because they're Jewish by accident of birth, and they're doing exactly what you just described. They are being used to insulate the haters and say, well, I can't be an anti-Semite because I have Jewish groups that are joining with me. But nobody is really giving a sense that they represent not even a fraction, but a fraction of a fraction of malcontents who don't identify as Jewish in any other way except to give cover to those that want to dump on Israel. In the case of Yara Sachs, and I don't hold the brief for Yara, you know, from her perspective, she comes by this honestly. She is absolutely committed to a safe and secure Jewish state, but she positions herself on the far left. She has a particular orientation. She's not alone. There are others like that too. The challenge with a Yara Sachs is that because there are so few Jews in Parliament, there's the expectation that she would reflect the views of the vast majority of the Jewish community. I'm not sure she always does that or that she's successful in doing that, but certainly you have to make a distinction between her and folks at Independent Jewish Voices who are anything but independent because they get all of their direction from the haters, Jewish only by accident of birth, and their voice is really just a platform to broadcast the hate and toxicity that's coming out from our adversaries.
Yeah, it's very, very well said. And I, my condolences to all that your community is enduring. But the one thing I've learned in my study of the history of the Jewish people and of Israel has been the story of resilience. So I know that you will get through this and you do have allies, even though it doesn't always feel like it. So Shimon Kofler-Fogel, thank you for coming on today.
My pleasure.
All right. Thank you. And I should just say, just by way of disclosure, I had the great privilege in 2015 of going on a Center for Israel and Jewish Affairs hosted visit of Israel. And it was my second trip to Israel. And I'm very grateful for the opportunity. And it wasn't tied to you have to say this or believe this or even write about it. It was just an opportunity to expose it. And I actually went with Candace Malcolm, who was also on the trip. We went into Bethlehem just on our own. We took a taxi and went across into the West Bank and saw the other side of this. And it was a fascinating experience. And I think a lot of people who weigh in on this and other issues should try to see it for themselves before they do. I want to bring things back home a bit more, though. Not that what we were talking about doesn't have have a very significant Canadian context. But you've heard me for weeks now talking about Bill C-63, which is the Liberal government's so-called Online Harms Act, a bill that, among other things, will introduce a new category of so-called hate speech and crack down on anyone who dares to utter it online, which effectively means the government is going to be the arbiter of what you can and can't say. And as we've seen, they are wildly inconsistent in when and how they flex this power. Now, I've often said that to understand how bad things are here, we need to take a look around the world and see where things are worse. And the UK has been one of the worst examples of this. You have police knocking on people's doors if they misgender someone on Twitter. They have this pervasive non-crime hate incident reporting system where you can do nothing illegal, but you still have a police record because you've perpetrated a non-crime hate incident. And I thought things were pretty bad in the UK, but I believe Ireland has come out with the Trump card. I'm not sure if you followed this or not, but Ireland has a new law purporting to rein in hate speech online. You have a couple of politicians that say Ireland's approach should actually be a model for all of Europe. And if that happens, I actually don't think it's going to be all that long before we see that brought to Canada. So I wanted to actually delve into what's happening in Ireland in a little bit of detail here, because this bill is called the Incitement to Violence or Hatred and Hate Offenses Bill. And it is one of the most Orwellian and draconian attempts at this so-called hate speech discussion I've ever seen. Ben Scallon has been on top of this. He is the senior political correspondent at Gripped, which is a fantastic independent media organization in Ireland. And he joins me now. Ben, it's good to talk to you. Thanks for coming on today.
Very good to talk to you today, Andrew. How are things?
Good, very well, thank you. Although in both of our countries, not exactly great on the free speech front. So for Canadians who have not paid attention to this at all, what's like the basic primer on what this bill is and why it's been raising so many alarms?
So in essence, if I had to describe why the Irish hate speech bill is so controversial, is it's the incredible vagueness of the text of the legislation to the point where the very serious crime of convicting somebody of a hate offense can be defined as almost anything. So I'll give you an example. For example, the text doesn't refer to hatred with any kind of specific definition. It says that hatred means hatred on the basis of X, Y, and Z characteristics, which is obviously a circular definition. So how is that to be defined? I guess it's up to the courts or the police or whoever happens to be offended by your remarks at the time. So people have been saying this is so open-ended, it could potentially catch anyone and everyone in its dragnet if we're making a very benign statement. Another example would be the fact that, according to the legislation, it's seeking to protect genders other than that of male or female. But it doesn't enumerate what those are. And when I asked our Taoiseach, which is like the Irish Prime Minister, how many genders are there in your view? Because previously the leader of our Senate said that there were about 9 genders. So that could be
about
8.
9. They don't even have the definitive list.
Exactly. It's a ballpark figure, thereabouts. And so I asked how many genders are there and what is covered by this legislation. And he said, we don't have an official position on that. And I'm sure that'll all be figured out during the debates. And they haven't been still. That was months ago. So that should kind of give you just a sense of why people are so concerned about this kind of thing. They're trying to protect genders they can't even define against hatred that they can't define. And it seems like the entire implementation of this legislation would just be totally up in the air. And how do you stay on the right side of a law that is so vague and nebulous? That's effectively the main concern that people have with it.
There are a lot of people that are not familiar with the evolution of Irish politics over the last, half a century, that are probably perplexed by Ireland's descent into wokeness, when this used to be this, traditional Catholic society and country. I mean, where did things all go so wrong? Because, even like you look at refugee policy in Ireland, for example, and this has been a very, very strange decline in a lovely country.
I think there's a few factors going on. I mean, of course, as you say, Ireland has always been a very historically deeply Catholic conservative country. There's the kind of old trope of Catholic families with, 50 kids running around and an icon of the Virgin Mary on the wall. And that's sort of the image that most people have had of Ireland for most of this country's existence. But I think obviously things like the abuse scandals in the Catholic Church did enormous damage and hurt trust with a lot of people. And so that hurt religiosity and mass attendance. And so I think in our haste to escape the church and to try and bury that part of our past because of all the scandals and controversies that came out of that, I think people have overcompensated and gone too much the other way. I think also NGOs have played a big role in the liberalization of society. I don't know how many people know this, but Ireland is a country of only about 5 million people, the Republic of Ireland anyway, and yet we have about 30,000 different NGO organizations, not even employees, but different groups. And these groups are heavily state-funded, most of them. In fact, some of them, they receive 96% of their funding from the government. So it's a strange kind of non-governmental organization that's almost entirely reliant on state funding. But there you go. So these groups are there mainly to promote LGBT rights or immigrant rights or women's rights or whatever it might be. But in many cases, that leads to problems, because if you're an organization that's set up to fight the boogeyman of racism, let's say, for example, the problem is Ireland isn't that racist of a country. We're actually a very tolerant country. And so you're out of the job in the same way. If you don't have leaky pipes, then you don't need a plumber. If you don't have a racist society, then you don't need professional anti-racist campaigners. And so these groups have had to try and manufacture the idea that Ireland is this horrendous place where women are treated as second-class citizens and gay people are seriously oppressed and everyone's a racist, when that's not the case. But they have to do that in order to perpetuate their existence. And so we have this kind of multi-billion euro NGO Borg conglomerate that exercises a lot of power over our discourse and our politics. And I think that also has played a big role in the liberalization of this country.
Well, and to bring it back to the hate speech bill, those groups you just mentioned are the ones that have skin in the games under these sort skin in the game under these sorts of regimes, because they're the ones that typically will systematize and weaponize these complaints processes, where you're going to have one of these NGOs just trolling Twitter for hours and hours every day, finding, oh, this person misgendered someone. And from what I've read, that could actually be a violation of this law.
Well, the justice minister has said that it won't. I asked her, can she guarantee that nobody will be convicted for misgendering? And she says, oh, absolutely, that'll never happen. That's not what the bill is intending to do. Whether she's correct or not, whether people believe her is up to them. I won't weigh in on that. That's what she's claimed. We've seen how these laws have been implemented in other jurisdictions, but she would probably say, oh, well, those are different pieces of legislation and we're going to do it properly and yada, yada.
But the defense is basically just trust us. You just have to trust that the government won't abuse this power.
Effectively, yeah. And I think as well, you know, one of the interesting things about it, you said that it's in these NGOs' interest to try and promote this. The government did a public consultation. I think in North America, you guys might call it a comment period, where this was several years ago. They floated the idea of hate speech laws. And they said, hey, you know, Joe Public, we want to know what you think. Weigh in with your thoughts. And they received thousands of responses from individuals and from groups. And then very shortly afterwards, they came out and they said, you know, we've received the feedback and now we're going to be going ahead with this legislation. Well, I actually, in a journalistic capacity, read through every single one of the responses, thousands of them. It took me hours and hours to do. And at the end of this research, I found that 73% of individuals had said that they didn't want it. They were negative responses saying, don't do this. The overwhelming consensus was mostly, of course, if somebody is engaging in violent rhetoric where they're calling for the public to attack an individual or a group or a race or something like that, of course, that should be illegal. And that already is illegal. You know, incitement to violence has never been covered under free speech. That's clearly not what we mean when we say free speech. And so that's already done. But other than that, if somebody is just merely expressing an offensive opinion that hurts somebody's feelings, tough luck. We all get offended sometimes. That's not something that the government should be legislating in. That was the general sentiment of the responses. And yet the government went ahead with it anyway, despite the fact that one of the groups they cited that said, oh, we got some positive responses. It was from these state-funded NGOs. So effectively, the people that you pay, that's like me saying, I'm the most handsome man in Ireland because that's what my granny says. You know, it's not really the most persuasive of sources you're using there, that you're appealing to people who you pay their salaries and fund them and keep them in existence. And lo and behold, they just so happen to agree with you and your policy agenda. Amazing how that works.
I mentioned in the intro, Sinead Gibney, who I think is the, she's running as the MEP, I think it's with the Social Democrats, and she is saying that she wants to basically export this to all of Europe. And I think it would probably be an easy sell to do that.
Yeah, I think that's, she said when I was interviewing her earlier in the week that she would be willing to support any legislation similar to the hate speech bill at a European-wide level. And we already have something like that, the Digital Services Act, which many people will be familiar with.
Well, and that was the model of what Canadian government officials were kind of using, which when I heard them say they were going to look to Europe for best practices, I was like, oh, please don't.
Yeah, that's not what you want to hear, definitely with the current state of European politics, where the amount of people who are willing to argue against some of these policies on principle are few and far between. That's a big thing that I think is missing from this debate as well, is that even some of the politicians who will speak out against the legislation will speak out against its practicalities. They'll say that, you know, it'll be very hard to implement, and logistically, I don't think it'll work. So on that basis, I'm opposing it. And I'm thinking, how about it's bad because it's wrong to censor people in general? You know, maybe we should start talking about, even if you could get the wording exactly right and hammer out this beautiful piece of legislation that covered all your bases, maybe we still shouldn't do it, even under those circumstances, because it's actually wrong to put people in jail for their opinions, even when their opinions are not views that you or I would necessarily find palatable. But that doesn't seem to come up during any of this discussion.
So obviously, Irish people, as you mentioned, were against this when it was floated to them, but I haven't seen mass outrage in the more recent months. There were some protests, but have people just generally gone along with it, or do they just not care enough? Why has there not been, or has there been, maybe I'm wrong, why has there not been a major pushback to this?
There has been a major pushback, and the reason we know that is because several government politicians, some of them who are veterans who have been around for years, have said in our Senate, basically, that they've received more correspondence about the hate speech bill than any other issue or piece of legislation in their political career. So it's obviously something that people are really incensed and energized about. And it hasn't been mentioned so much in the last couple of months, only because it's being supplanted by other controversies like immigration. We have a huge immigration crisis at the minute in this country and a massive influx of asylum seekers. We have tent cities popping up in the capital city because there's nowhere to put some of these individuals who are arriving, and there's more arriving every day. We had a couple of progressive referendums there a couple of weeks ago, which were defeated. The government side of that debate was defeated comprehensively. So there's been other chaotic things happening that may have taken attention away from the hate speech bill, but the government have not pursued it, which I think is sort of an indication that they know they're losing momentum on it. They meant to pass it last summer. They didn't do that. Then they said, oh, we'll pass it after the summer. They didn't do that. And then they said, oh, we'll pass it by the end of the year. And we're now in March and still no sign of it. So they keep kicking the can down the road, hoping the pressure will alleviate. But I think if they tried to sneak it through, people might have something to say about that, especially with upcoming elections later in the year.
Well, let's hope they will keep kicking and kicking and kicking, and eventually it'll just be lost forever. Ben Scallon with Gripped, great to have you on and demystifying this for those of us across the Atlantic. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much. Great to be here.
All right. That does it for us for today. We'll be back with, no, we won't be back tomorrow, but I will be on Off the Record tomorrow with Candace Malcolm and Harrison Faulkner, then back with another edition of The Andrew Lawton Show on Monday. So thank you, God bless, and have a great weekend.
Thanks for listening to The Andrew Lawton Show. Support the program by donating to True North at www.tnc.news.